Chapter 1. The ship rumbled as they rode out the last few minutes of their 10th and final braking burn on approach to Tau Ceti 5. Jack looked down at the display at the center of his forward console. He didn't like the numbers he was seeing, and a discreet glance to his right told him that his pilot didn't like them either. "A little fast, Lynn?" he asked. She responded with only a nod, her concentration focused on the task at hand. Jack turned his head slightly toward the rear of the flight deck, as if to speak to his engineer. It was a completely unnecessary gesture, since everyone was required to wear their comm sets during any condition other than green. "Frank, what's our estimated velocity at the end of the burn?"
"Estimated velocity at the end of the burn will be,
Frank paused for a moment as he glanced at his displays to be sure.
49105 meters per second, Frank answered. Give or take a meter.
Jack scowled. At that velocity, they'd still be going too fast to safely perform an aerobraking maneuver and achieve a stable orbit around Tau Ceti 5, and they didn't have enough fuel to burn the main engines any longer than scheduled. Jack thought about it for a moment, weighing his options.
"That's not good enough," he concluded. "Take the reactor up to 110%.
"The flight manual says no more than 105.
As usual, Lynn was putting in her 2 cents.
110%, Frank,"
Jack repeated firmly, annoyed at Lynn for questioning his decision.
"It's too risky, Jack," she objected. "You know what happens if the reactor fails, don't you?"
"Yes, I do, Lynn."
Jack was biting back his anger through gritted teeth.
"Then why not just burn the engines a little longer?
We don't have the fuel for it."
"We can make it up."
"Just fly the damn ship, Linny!"
Jack snapped, cutting her off mid-sentence. Lynn instantly fell silent, her mouth still open as she returned her attention to her console. Jack rarely yelled at her like that, and he never used that awful nickname. Only Frank used it, and only when he wanted to irritate her.
"Reactor at 110, Jack,"
Frank interrupted, trying to ease the tension.
"Thrust velocity coming up."
Jack stared at the ship's velocity readout on the display. The numbers slowly began to decline as the ship's rate of deceleration increased.
"Revised estimated velocity at end of burn, 47500.
It still wouldn't be enough for Jack. Frank knew that Jack wanted to finish this burn with room to spare.
"Take her up to 115, Frank,"
Jack ordered, glaring at Lynn before she could object any further. Frank took a deep breath, blowing it out slowly.
115, aye,
he responded, trying to sound formal, hoping that Lynn might take the hint. Frank scanned the reactor's status displays, watching intently for any anomalies. Satisfied that the reactor was operating within safe tolerances, he turned his attention to the flight dynamics display, knowing that Jack would ask for another estimate any second.
"Revised estimate, 46950. 15 seconds to end of burn."
"Very well," Jack replied,
trying not to show the nervousness in his voice. The remaining 7 members of the crew were secured in their flight seats in the narrow passageway between the inner airlock and the habitat module of the land and return vehicle. The passageway was only 2 meters wide at the deck and 1 meter wide at the ceiling, with 2 rows of 4 seats, each row stuffed under the inboard edge of the LRV's forward turbine housings. Tony, the mission's computer and electronics specialist, sat at the forward end of the compartment in the only center-mounted chair, watching the flight status monitor on the forward bulkhead above the hatch. It was his responsibility to supervise the evacuation of the rest of the crew in the event of an emergency. He was glad that the braking burns were almost over. They had been going through this for the last 2 weeks. Burn for an hour, brake for 15, and repeat, sometimes for more than half a ship's day. Then flip the ship over again and spend a day or two scooping up interstellar hydrogen to process into fuel. Today's series of burns had lasted only 4 hours, but it had been a boring 4 hours, stuck in his couch for 30 minutes at a time, sometimes with no more than a few minutes' rest in between. But it was no small feat to decelerate a vessel from nearly 40% the speed of light to a velocity safe for aerobraking.
Frank carefully watched the reactor's status displays. He had never seen a reactor run at 115% of normal. Hell, he had never seen one run at 100% before this mission. The reactors back on the Daedalus had never been taken higher than 75%, as far as he knew. "Reactor is running a tad hot, but otherwise it still looks good," Frank reported. 10 seconds to end a burn." He looked at the back of Lynn's head. As usual, her hair was tied up in a bun. He noticed beads of sweat forming on the back of her neck. He glanced at Jack's neck, noticing it was bone dry. 5 seconds, he reported, turning back to his console. Jack hovered over his display. Their velocity was down to 47.25 kilometers per second. It was going to be close. 4. Lynn's gaze was fixed on her flight path display, still furious with Jack for snapping at her. 3. Jack checked his flight data display again. Their velocity was 47.125. 2. Frank glanced at the primary propellant gauges, quickly verifying that they would finish with exactly the amount of propellant they had intended. Jack was taking his ship to the limit, squeezing every milliliter of propellant out of her. 1. Frank's right hand hovered over the flashing main engine cutoff button located on one of the 3 touch-sensitive screens placed in a shallow arc across his console. 0, he announced, his hand still in position, ready for Jack to give the order. A second passed, but Jack said nothing, his eyes still fixed on the display. Finally, after another second and a half, he spoke up. "Miko," Jack instructed, calmly. Frank's hand tapped the main engine cutoff button. Silence fell over the Icarus as her main engines instantly shut down. Jack looked over at Lynn, noting what could be a satisfied look on her face. Their velocity was 46.75 kilometers per second. Jack would have preferred to be below 46, but this would have to do. He was still within the limits set forth in their flight plan. Besides, he had already encroached on their max propellant usage for the burn. He was now a few hundred kilograms short for their trip from Tau Ceti 5 to their next assignment at Tau Ceti 6. He wondered how late that might make them. A day? A week? He'd have to remember to ask Frank to make the calculations for him later. Maybe he'd get lucky, and they'd finish up their work on TC-5 a few days ahead of schedule. That would give them a few extra days for the slightly lower transit speed they would need during the next leg to accommodate the additional propellant expenditure. "Shutdown of main engines confirmed," Frank announced, as he reached for the reactor's control panel. "Reactor back down to 50%, Jack quickly ordered. Frank had started rolling down the reactor output levels before Jack had given the order. "Reactor coming down," Frank reported. "Mains are cold, master arm is safe, fuel pumps are off. Reactor plant, nominal." Frank turned his chair forward and announced, "Show's over, folks." "Set condition green," Jack directed. "And stand by to pitch over, Lynn."
"Aye, sir," Lynn replied, her emphasis clearly on sir.
Frank laughed to himself, shaking his head as he selected shipwide on the comm panel.
"All hands secure from condition blue, set condition green,"
Frank's voice crackled over their comm sets.
"6 hours to aero braking."
Back in the passenger compartment, the rest of the crew gladly began unbuckling their restraint harnesses.
"Oh, that last burn was the worst," Laura complained as she unfastened her harness. "My back hasn't been this sore since training."
Mac, the mission's mechanic, wasted no time leaving his seat.
"Oh, I'm getting something to eat," he announced, as he quickly moved forward between the aisles.
"You can't possibly be hungry again," Sarah asked,
as she stood sideways in the aisle, pressing her hands against the overhead and stretching her arms upward.
"Hey, it takes a lot of food to fuel this fine specimen of manhood."
"Oh, please,"
Sarah retorted, rolling her eyes in disgust. Mac knew that his obsession with his physical condition was lost on the rest of the crew, but he especially enjoyed irritating Sarah. He floated sideways down the aisle, purposefully brushing his chest up against her arms as she stretched.
"Oh, baby," he sneered, as he glanced down at her breasts.
Sarah grabbed his shirt and pushed him forward, away from her. "Get lost, Neanderthal!" She had spent the last 4 months locked up with the man. She had been subjected to sexual innuendos, unbridled chauvinism, lewd remarks, and even the occasional grope. And it had not been much better during their year-long training regimen before the mission began.
"She wants me,"
Mac whispered to his considerably less offensive cohort, Tony, as he passed by him near the forward hatch.
"Ooh, one of these days, I'm gonna blast that jerk out of an airlock," Sarah grumbled.
Maria, the mission's medical officer, rose from her seat.
"He just behaves that way because he knows he can get a rise out of you. If you just ignored him..."
Sarah pushed past Maria, as if she were chasing after Mac.
"Thanks, Doc," Sarah replied, dismissively. "But I think I can handle it."
"Honestly, Maria, I don't know why you even bother with her,"
Laura protested, as she drifted over the tops of the seatbacks, heading forward.
What can I say? She's a challenging case."
Laura drifted forward toward the airlock between the flight deck and the passenger space. Tony was already in the airlock, securing some equipment.
"Torpedo?"
Laura asked him, turning into an excitable child for a moment. Tony laughed. It was a private game that he and Laura played at the end of each burn series.
"Stand by to launch torpedo,"
he agreed, shaking his head in dismay. This woman was 32 years old, a mother of four, and an expert in biogenetics, and yet here she was, pretending she was a torpedo. Laura flipped over 180 degrees in the middle of the airlock, inverting herself and positioning her head just above the hatch in the deck, her feet nearly touching the overhead.
"Clear the tube," she announced.
From deep down within the Icarus below her, Mac's faint voice could be heard from the galley.
"Tube is clear."
"Torpedo ready for launch,"
she responded gleefully. Tony positioned himself next to her, hooking his toes under the hatch ring. He grabbed her ankles, feeling her legs stiffen as she prepared herself for launch. He pushed down on her ankles, propelling her down the transfer tube.
"Torpedo away," Tony announced,
as he pushed her toward the midship airlock of the Icarus. The tube was nearly 10 meters long, with a smooth handrail running along its starboard side. It connected the Icarus and the land and return vehicle, allowing transfer between the main ship and the landing craft affixed to her topside. Laura squealed with delight as she quickly traversed the length of the tube. As she approached the bottom, she saw Mac step into the airlock below her and release a 2-liter container of water, the fluid separating into several large globules that floated directly into her flight path.
"Mac!"
she screamed as she fumbled for the handrail. But it was too late. Entering the airlock at the bottom of the tube, she collided with the water globules, drenching her head and shoulders as her outstretched arms touched the airlock's padded deck plates in a clumsy attempt to stop her momentum.
"You jerk!"
she cursed as she bounced off the deck, spinning clumsily, flinging water droplets about the airlock.
"Torpedo destroyed!"
Mac boasted from beyond the galley hatch. Laura wiped the water from her face as she floated in the airlock.
"You knew he was going to do that, Tony."
"I had no idea,"
Tony defended from the top of the tube as he tried not to laugh.
"Honest."
"Oh, look at this mess,"
Laura complained.
"How am I going to clean?"
Before she could even finish her sentence, a small towel came floating in from the aft hatch, obviously sent there by Mac from the galley next door.
"Oh, thank you very much,"
she said, grabbing the towel as it floated by. Adia entered the airlock next. It was still difficult for her to navigate in zero gravity, even after 4 months of practice. She gingerly made her way past Tony, excusing herself as she passed. Unlike most of the others, she preferred to go down the tube feet first, always keeping her head in the direction that she interpreted as being up, in order to maintain her bearings. Suddenly, the attitude thrusters fired, pitching the nose of the ship downward, throwing Adia toward the ceiling. She reached out to grab the side rail along the equipment lockers, but grabbed a handful of Tony's shirt by accident.
"Sorry,"
she apologized, her cheeks flushed with embarrassment as she withdrew her hand.
"Wait,"
Tony warned, grabbing her arm and surprising her. It's not over.
The thruster sounded again, and the pitch over suddenly stopped.
I guess I still haven't gotten my space legs yet, she admitted, as Tony let go.
That's all right, he consoled her. After all, you didn't have nearly the training time the rest of us had.
She knew he was only being polite. The others had been just as nice at first, but had soon grown tired of her difficulty adapting.
And yet, here I am, she said, without thinking.
Here you are, Tony replied, with a broad smile.
Adia stared at him for a brief moment, taken aback by his wide, genuine smile. But the moment soon became uncomfortable, and she felt the need to retreat.
Excuse me, she dismissed politely, quickly lowering herself into the tube.
Tony watched as she descended, her long ponytail swaying about unnaturally in the microgravity environment. He positioned himself for descent, then noticed Will was still in the passenger space.
"You coming, Will?"
he asked, as he dove down the tube.
"In a moment,"
answered the quiet geologist.
Pitch over complete. Pitch attitude zero relative to course. Maneuvering thrusters off, Frank reported.
Jack unlocked his seat base and pivoted to face Lynn. Frank winced, knowing what was coming next.
Good work, Lynn,
Jack praised her calmly.
But the next time we're in a maneuver and you don't agree with my orders, I suggest you keep it to yourself.
Frank was surprised that Jack had delivered the line so sedately. He knew that Jack was angry. He had been putting up with Lynn's disrespectful questioning for some time. And although Jack could be aggressive in his decision-making, Frank had complete confidence in him. Jack had been training for this mission far longer than anyone else on board, and had spent countless hours immersed in simulations, reacting to every crisis scenario the programmers could throw at him. No one knew more about the overall mission than Jack, not even the mission designers themselves. Yet Lynn had questioned his decisions nearly every step of the way, ever since they had awakened from suspended animation.
I was only trying to help, she responded.
There's a time and place to offer an opinion, Lynn, Jack advised her, again biting back his anger. And there's a time and place to follow orders, without question.
And I suppose, Lynn shot back, that if you were about to make a dangerous error in judgment, that would not be the time or place?
I'll tell you what, Miss Blakely, Jack seethed. Once you have 2 years in command training, 3 upper-level degrees in mission-applicable disciplines, and 1,500 hours in the simulator, then you can question my judgment. In the meantime, I suggest you shut the hell up and follow orders, or I'll toss you out the airlock and fly the fucking ship myself. Is that understood?
Lynn recoiled in her seat, her mouth agape.
Yes, sir,
was all she could say in response. Frank stared at his console, calling up routine diagnostics and trying to stay inconspicuous and out of harm's way as Jack passed by him. Jack entered the airlock just aft of the fly deck, nearly colliding with Will as he dove headfirst down the access tube, all without saying another word. Will, who was already nervous around Jack, turned around and retreated into the passenger compartment. Frank, upon witnessing his friend's rapid exit, turned his attention back to his console, letting out a long sigh. Lynn just stared at her forward console in shock, trying to find the nerve to speak.
"Well, you're the engineer, Frank," she finally said. "Was I right or wrong?"
"Oh, you don't get it, do you?" Frank sighed. "It's not a question of who's right and who's wrong. It's a question of responsibility. Jack is the one who is responsible for everything. It's his decision, Lynn, not yours."
"I am second in command, technically."
"Technically, yes, you are, but that doesn't mean that you are anywhere near as qualified or experienced as Jack."
"And I'm a lot younger than he is."
Frank shook his head in amazement.
"You really need to stop beating that drum, Lynn. Age has got nothing to do with it. It's about experience and training, and you know it."
"I've got quite a bit of sim time, too, you know."
"A few hundred hours is nothing," Frank replied.
And there's more to being in command than just time in the simulator.
It's not my fault that I was added to the crew at the last minute, Lynn protested.
Yes, you were, Frank agreed. And no, it's not your fault. But you'd be better off just following Jack's lead. You might even learn something.
So I shouldn't say anything, even if I think there's a better way?
Frank stared at her for a moment. He wasn't sure if she didn't understand the extent of her transgression for lack of maturity or because of the rapid fashion in which she had been trained. Lynn had been called to serve as mission pilot and second-in-command after Doral Ishkin had passed away from complications of radiation exposure. The poor girl had been tossed into a simulator only a few days before their launch date.
"Your job isn't to suggest alternatives," Frank explained. "Not unless you're asked for them, and especially not in the middle of a mission-critical maneuver."
"I was told that Jack welcomes advice from his crew," Lynn said.
"Of course he does. Jack knows his stuff, but everyone is capable of forgetting something now and again. You just have to develop a little tact and better timing."
"I see," she responded, somewhat half-heartedly.
"Command is a lonely business, Lynn."
Frank turned back to his console. "Someday, you'll understand that." Lynn turned back to her station and began silently running down her post-maneuver checklist. Frank had said a lot, maybe even too much. She was young, and her ego bruised easily. But she had bent the rules too far and had been punished for her sins. Frank knew that both his and Jack's words hurt her. He wanted to offer her a shoulder to lean on, but understood that her ego wouldn't accept that. She needed the truth, and that's what he had given her. By the time Jack got to the midship airlock, his anger at Lynn had subsided. He was sorry he had yelled at her, but she had cost them several seconds of time, during which the reactor could have been running hotter, maybe getting their speed down even further. Then he might not have needed to burn those last few extra seconds, wasting precious propellant.
"Hey, boss!"
Mac greeted him from the food prep area along the port side of the galley.
"You want some of this?"
he offered, as he pulled the spout of the feeding tube off of the blender's transfer spout.
No thanks,"
Jack declined, as he floated through the galley on his way aft. Mac squeezed the tube and forced a large globule out of the tip. It filled the room with a foul stench as it floated in the air, quivering like a small handful of pudding before being sucked into his mouth.
"You sure?"
Mac tempted, smacking his lips.
"It'll put hair on your chest."
The nauseating aroma reached Jack's nose, causing him to recoil.
"Oh, jeez, Mac. What the hell is that stuff?"
"I call it a protein cream dream," Mac boasted. "It's the most complete food source on board."
"And the smelliest," Jack added, holding his nose. "I'm definitely going to pass."
"Suit yourself,"
Mac shrugged, not the slightest bit offended.
"But you don't know what you're missing."
Jack pulled himself along the handrail, heading into the wardroom. The entire crew habitat was designed as a long, flattened, octagonal tube, with overhead rails that ran along either side of the ceiling for the entire length of each compartment. There were shorter runs of railing placed strategically along the sides of the compartment, making it easy to navigate along any of the eight walls. Hand and footholds were set generously, along with fold-out anchoring arms that could attach to one of four sockets on a crew member's belt to hold them in place while they performed tasks. Laura and Maria had become quite adept at using these devices. They were both anchored to the wall opposite the view screen. Between them, a plastic container, constructed by Maria, was also anchored to the wall. It held various snacks inside plastic bags that they could push their hands through to access the contents within. With food and drink handy, Maria and Laura appeared to be spending their free time, as usual, anchored in place, eyes fixed on the view screen, chatting away. This time, however, rather than old Earth movies, they were watching their most recent video mail from their families back on the Daedalus, getting one last fix before going down to the surface. Jack passed through the aft hatch of the wardroom, traveling into the berthing corridor. This smaller octagonal passageway had birthing tubes on each side, 4 on the right and 5 on the left. Each tube was 2.5 meters long by 1.5 meters in diameter, giving a person just enough room to squat or lie down. Each berth had plenty of small lockers and storage pockets located strategically in every nook and cranny. There were climate controls, ventilation fans, overhead reading lights, a fold-out desk, and a zero-gravity sleep sack. There was no room for clothing storage inside the berths, but larger lockers accommodated that necessity near the bottom of each berthing tube's entrance. Such close quarters had led to less modesty among the crew of the Icarus, and the berths had been designed as a sort of hideaway, where the occupant could be guaranteed some private time. Of course, Adia had been the exception to that rule, being the most bashful of the group. She was also the most petite, and probably the only one who could change her clothes inside a berthing tube without bruising or dislocating something. Jack continued aft, requiring only one pull at the forward end of the compartment to give himself enough momentum to travel its length, arriving at the door to his cabin on the port side. It was the only truly private cabin on board, and more than 3 times the size of the standard berthing tubes. But it came with a price, as it was right next to the bathroom. He drifted past Sarah's cabin, where she was busily preparing her belongings to transfer to the LRV. Typical, Jack thought. Always waiting until the last minute. She saw him pass by and stuck her head out of her berth.
When are you going to say something to that ape, Jack?
Right after we get down to the surface, Jack replied, as he drifted by. Across from Sarah's berth was Wills, the mission's planetologist. Will spent most of his time in his berth and had been somewhat reclusive for the duration of the mission. He was a brilliant scientist, but Jack wondered if Will lacked the motivation and can-do attitude required for such an assignment. Jack was also curious about what Will did in his berth. He sometimes spent full days in there, only coming out to eat and use the bathroom. Jack knew from the ship's logs that he had downloaded many books from the ship's digital library onto his data pad. But that was a hell of a lot of reading, even for someone like Will. Jack had once overheard Maria telling Laura that Will had some sort of journal that he wrote in. A physical journal, with actual paper. Even though they all knew how to write by hand and occasionally used a stylus on data pads, no one had used paper and pen for centuries. Jack couldn't imagine where Will had gotten any paper to begin with. It certainly wasn't manufactured on board the Daedalus, and he was sure that their predecessors hadn't brought any with them when they left Luna Station. Jack opened the door to his cabin and floated inside, pulling it closed behind him. At first, he had wondered why the designers had felt it necessary in a vessel that maximized every cubic centimeter of space for the captain to have a larger berth. But now, after months of dealing with equipment malfunctions, calculation errors, childish pranks, petty crew squabbles, and other minutiae, he appreciated the designer's wisdom. Jack reached the port bulkhead opposite the door and pulled down his fold-out desk. Swinging out the small seat from the forward bulkhead, he assumed a sitting position and placed the restraining belt across his lap. He slid the keyboard out from under the view screen, which came to life automatically, and began typing. As many as 10 times a day, Jack would venture back to his cabin to record entries into his log, lest he forget an important detail of that day's actions, operations, and decisions. It was an annoyance, but one that he shared with the ship's engineer and the ship's medical officer. Just as he was finishing his log entry, a familiar knock came from his door. Jack knew what was coming.
"Enter."
"Can I speak with you a moment, sir?"
Frank requested, rather formally, probably for the benefit of anyone listening from the corridor.
"Of course."
Jack gestured for him to enter. Frank closed the door behind him, and suddenly dropped his formality, wedging himself into a corner above the cabinet that ran along the aft bulkhead.
"How's the hand?" Frank asked.
"Fine. Maria says the closures can come off in about a week." Jack rubbed the bandage wrapped around the palm of his right hand.
"Still can't grab anything very well, though."
He looked at Frank.
"But you didn't come in here to ask me about my hand, did you?"
Well, not really, Frank admitted. I suppose you think I was too hard on her.
Yeah, a little, maybe.
You know she deserved it, Jack said, his tone raising the statement to a question.
I'm not saying she didn't, Frank agreed. I just think you could have been more, what's the word I want?
Tactful, Jack suggested.
Oh, then you've heard of this word? Frank teased.
Yeah, smartass, I've heard of it.
Huh, just checking.
Point taken, Jack conceded. It's just, every damn time I make a decision, she's spouting off against it. How much of that am I supposed to take, anyway?
Like I said, Jack, she had it coming, no doubt about it.
Frank let out a long breath.
She's just young, you know, and she knows that she didn't come to this mission through normal means. She's just trying to prove herself to you.
What am I, her big brother or something?
More like a father figure, I would guess, Frank corrected.
Oh, great. I have to be a father figure as well, Jack lamented. That's all I need.
You know, Jack, when she got the position, it really upset her father. He wanted her to follow in either his or her mother's footsteps, just like everyone else has always done. It was pretty difficult for her. I mean, she's only the fifth person who didn't follow in their parents' footsteps in choosing a career. It's been our way for over 60 years. The council takes procedure seriously. Hell, they all but caused the Luton movement.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I don't think her father even said goodbye to her when we left.
I didn't know that.
I think she's just looking for acceptance.
She doesn't really fit in with Laura and Maria in the Mother's Club, and Adia and Will are too reclusive to hit it off with anyone.
And the testosterone twins.
Who?
Jack asked. Mac and Tony, Frank explained. Sarah nicknamed them the testosterone twins. Kind of fits, actually. Anyway, they're too macho for her. And I think Sarah scares Lynn.
Hell, Sarah scares me.
Jack was surprised at Frank's assessment of the crew. He had never known his friend to play the psychologist.
I guess I see what you mean.
Jack rubbed his sore right hand through the bandage.
So, what do you suggest? Jack asked. How should I handle her?
Maybe the next time you have to cut her short, you can take the time to explain your logic to her. If there's time, of course, help her learn.
Practical advice, Jack agreed. But I still think it would be easier to toss her out the airlock.
She'd probably put up too much of a fight, Frank laughed.
That she would, Jack chuckled. I just have one question for you, Frank.
What's that?
When the hell did you become such an expert in psychology?
Frank laughed, straightening up from where he had wedged himself in, and turned to leave.
I had a few discreet conversations with Maria.
Oh, great,
Jack objected, in mock anger.
So now the ship's physician knows about it.
Hey, what are friends for?
Frank joked, as he drifted out the door. Jack let out a long breath.
Crap,
he thought to himself. He was tired of dealing with everyone's problems and insecurities. This position was akin to babysitting a bunch of children, not at all what he had expected. Being in command of a mission of exploration was supposed to be challenging, exciting, and adventurous. So far, it was proving tedious and boring. He thought back to the stories his great-grandfather used to tell about his days back on Earth, flying a rescue helicopter for the Navy, first off a carrier and then out of San Diego. On his bird, as he called it, he had plucked many a downed pilot out of the ocean, often in the midst of storms. When he took his first command in San Diego, his great-grandfather had a whole squadron under him. He had even flown, and eventually commanded, the space shuttle. That had led to his most exciting assignment, commanding Luna Station for the Eden Project. He had been in charge of the very facilities that would later build the Daedalus and the Icarus. It was no wonder that Jack's great-grandfather had ended up commanding the Daedalus for the first 30 years of its journey. Jack had been fascinated by his great-grandfather's stories when he was a young lad. Fascinated and inspired. It had been his great-grandfather's ramblings, as his father referred to them, that made Jack want to become a pilot, and then to seek command of the Icarus. It had upset his mother and father to no end. Jack's grandfather, Alex, had died as the result of being in command, and at his widow's request, Jack's father had followed in his mother's career path instead of his father's and great-grandfather's. Thus, Jack's parents had expected him to follow in their footsteps and become a teacher. It was a role that was well respected in Dedalian society. Unfortunately, it wasn't for Jack. He wanted something more exciting. He wanted to command this mission.
Huh. Some excitement, Jack thought, almost bitterly.
He removed his lap restraint and rose from his seat, floating in the center of his room. He stuck his fingertips inside the ventilation ducts, indenting the edge of the ceiling's dome light fixture. Hooking his toes into the floor restraints, he twisted his body around, stretching out the muscles in his back, shoulders, and chest. He repeated this ritual at least 3 times a day. It felt so good. He knew he must be at least 3 centimeters taller after 4 months in zero gravity, and wondered how long it would take for his spinal column to compress back to normal once on the planet's surface. Finished with his stretches, Jack kicked off his deck shoes, leaving them floating on the other side of the room. He pulled out his sleep sack from a locker, hooking each end to opposite bulkheads. He unzipped it and climbed inside, zipping up only the interior netting to hold him floating in place. He reached up and turned off the overhead light, leaving the bunk light on behind his head. He looked at the pictures on the wall to his right. His wife and children, his parents, and great-grandpa, still alive after all these years. The old guy was one of only 3 original crew members still living, and would be celebrating his 108th birthday on the surface of the new world, whichever one they ended up choosing. Jack switched off the light and turned the room ventilators on high to drown out extraneous noises from elsewhere in the ship, a trick old man Wilkins had taught him many years ago. In the darkness, he worried about all the personnel problems he had dealt with in the last few months. Oh well, I'm sure everyone will find it easier to get along after we get down on the surface and get a little more elbow room, he thought, as he closed his eyes and drifted off to sleep.